Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Good afternoon. Please be seated. My name's Tim. I'm an alcoholic. Again, my name is Tim. I'm an alcoholic. Before we get started, I need to explain. This is an AA convention defined as a special event. It is not regular AA. It is a special event. If you have questions about special events, please pick up a copy of the GSO special events handout at the hospitality desk. We also attempted to put a copy in everyone's little clean and sober bag. So if you have any questions, those will probably answer the questions. If not, come and see one of the committee members. Now, you may hear something about AA during this presentation today. However, this is not an AA meeting as such. It's an informational and educational presentation. Consequently, we will dispense with the normal reading of AA literature. However, the subject of this presentation is alcoholism and addiction. From past experience, I can tell you it promises to be most entertaining and enlightening. We are very fortunate to have with us again today a good friend to many of us, originally from Dublin, Ireland, now living in Beverly Hills, California, an MD, a doctor of medicine and psychiatry, formerly a professor of psychiatry at the University of California, Los Angeles, a director and past president of the American Society of Addiction Medicine. More than 25 years specializing in the field of addiction medicine. Currently the chief of psychiatry at the Betty Ford Center in Rancho Mirage, California. I could go on and on regarding his credentials. However, I will mention only one other point of interest. Among other things, he is also an FAA instrument rated pilot. I have personally flown with him in a Lockheed 1011 heavy jet airline simulator. True story. He can talk about it if he wishes. So it's a great pleasure. I present my friend and yours, Dr. Garrett O'Connor.
Thank you very much, Tim. My name is Garrett and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Garrett.
In that Lockheed simulator, I actually re-entered the hangar without the benefit of opening the door and created havoc. Let me tell you a story first, where I come from, Dublin, Ireland. About 1982, I was about 4 years sober at the time, and I was back there working and driving home late one night, about 1 o'clock in the morning, along the Sea Road, and there had been a bank robbery that afternoon in Dublin, and the police were out in droves, and they had a police block. And there were three or four cars ahead of me, and I drove up slowly. And when I got to the police block, a big burly country policeman came up, and he looked in the front window. And he came around the side. We drive on the right-hand side. He came around the side, and I put down the window, and he looked in at me. "You're looking very doleful." I said, "Ha, doleful? No, officer, I'm just tired. I've been working all night." "Working, is it? But how much have you had to drink?" I said, "Officer, actually, I haven't had a drop to drink for 4 years." "Hmm. That must be what's the matter with you," he said. I come from a country, and he had no instruction in his manual as to how to advise a sober driver to proceed. So, well, this is after lunch, so hypoglycemia sometimes takes over from a medical point of view, so I will authorize anyone here to nod off or whatever at will, and this is your authority to do so in advance. true in my first effort to hypnotize a person at Johns Hopkins in 1961. I went to sleep and the patient remained firmly awake. It's a true story. Well, we're going to talk this afternoon. Indeed, there will be some AA. There'll be hopefully recovery. And I want to bring you up to date about certain aspects of the disease of alcoholism. You'll probably not hear anything from me that you don't know already, but you may see it in a different context. Because I want to bring you up to date on some of the recent research, the extraordinary research that has been done in the last 5 to 10 years that merely confirms what's written in the big book in 1939, that alcoholism and addiction is a disease, it's a brain disease, and it's an obsession of the mind, and a disease of the body. And here we have now 50, 60, 75 years later scientific proof of that. And I want to talk about that, and I want to talk about the ramifications of that for alcoholic addicted behavior and also, of course, for recovery. Only three things you really need to know. First of all, addiction is a brain disease. They said that in the big book. No news to that, but now we have scientific evidence that it is. And that people use drugs and alcohol because we like what it does to our brains. Makes sense. Chronic prolonged use of drugs and alcohol changes the brain in fundamental and long-lasting ways. Those of us who have been through addiction and detox and recovery know that to be a fact. And those people around us know that to be a fact. But most people think we were just sons of bitches and not suffering from a brain disease and that we had a weak character and if only we were stronger and were more sensible and more or less selfish and so on, we wouldn't be as bad as we were. Addiction is a result of our brains becoming rewired, literally rewired, during drug and alcohol use. And recovery, it now shows, rewires the brain again back into its pre-addicted phase or state, which is an extraordinary discovery because it means that AA, spiritual recovery, remains the technology, the central technology of treatment ultimately for addiction. There are many other things that can contribute to that, but that is by far the most effective way of achieving long-term treatment. That's a picture of a brain. And the addicted brain operates under different rules. We know that, but the vast majority of people don't know that. They don't know that once these drugs get into our systems and into our brains, we are commanded, tyrannized, to behave in ways that deny us choice. Initially, there may be a choice in the early days of abuse, but with dependence, choice is removed. And we know that again scientifically now. We don't have a choice in what we do. Unless some event occurs, some detoxification, some spiritual intervention, some intervention like John will talk about on Saturday morning and so on occurs, naturally or artificially, to interrupt the cycle. But all of these drugs have this extraordinary impact on our behavior. The third thing you need to know is that treatment, detoxification, plus 12-step works. And we'll see the appalling problem with that in the medical profession in just a moment. The big challenge facing addiction treatment and recovery at the moment, at least in the United States, is where I work and what I know best, is to integrate 12-step spirituality and to retain that as the core technology of treatment and recovery. There are many places in the States where I go, John goes, and other people go, and we see rehab centers beginning to look like psychiatric institutions. Because the idea of addiction being a brain disease is now translated medically by people who do not understand recovery and 12-step recovery into the idea that the treatment for a brain disease is drugs, other drugs, which in most cases simply extends the addictive thinking of the addict who has always used drugs or other forms of stimulation to solve problems. On the other hand, there are certain people who will not be able to recover without drugs. And they are people with disorders confirmed, like manic depressive disease, bipolar disorder, certain forms of stimulation disorder, chronic depression, recurrent depressions, and so on. And we must make sure those people get drugs so as they can participate in the recovery process, and at the same time make sure that the people who don't need drugs don't get them, because giving them drugs like Prozac, like Effexor, like Zoloft, all of these new drugs that are for anxiety and depression, may impede their recovery by softening the process which requires a period of what I call authentic suffering. To move from the culture of addiction into the culture of recovery, you cannot go from one to the other without a period of authentic suffering. And if you obliterate that for people, you are not doing them a favor. In fact, you are impeding their recovery. It's a very critical moment, a very optimistic moment in addiction treatment, but it's very critical because this has to be survived and this has to be retained as the core technology. Then there's neurobiology, and we'll look at some of the extraordinary advances from neurobiology, and we will also then look at 21st century psychopharmacology, which is an entirely new brand of drugs coming out and sometimes indiscriminately used by psychiatrists and other physicians who don't understand the relationship of drugs to intoxication and drugs to chronic chemical dependence. We know that treatment works because we've worked with pilots and attorneys and physicians in safety-sensitive positions now for 30 years. And longer treatment, plus 12-step, plus job or license jeopardy, and mandatory monitoring for 5 years produces 85% recovery rates in pilots and physicians. And what we're trying to do now is repeat this formula for ordinary people who are not as highly prestigious, highly paid, or who do not have such safety premiums attached to their positions. But that is the formula, that is the optimum formula for achieving long-term success in addictions. We all know that, and it's an illness of the soul. I think of myself as a soul. Actually, in the aviation community has it right. On your flight plan, it says how many souls aboard. Right. Not people, they say souls aboard. When you're reporting in case you have a crash, they want to know how many souls were on the plane. Imagine counting souls in the back seat. Addiction is a cunning, powerful baffling. That's what Bill Wilson said in the big book. And I've added dangerous, devious, ugly, and hidden disease of groups. It is a group disease. Families, workplaces, classrooms, nations, that policeman in Dublin. He was affected by it himself and so on. Here they are, addicted family members, co-addicted members, relatives, everybody's involved. Whole governments are involved in this extraordinary denial and mismanagement of addiction. So that Gorbachev, for example, in Russia, that's the real reason as to why he was put out of office. He said in 1987 that alcohol, vodka, was the number one problem in Russia. And then began to behave as if that was the thing by putting sanction on vodka production. And the next thing was he was out of office, and who did they put in? Yeltsin, the most chronic alcoholic they could find. Who, like most of the people in this room, was great for a weekend revolution full of power and panache. But when you ask him to run something for 6 years, that's codependency. There are all of these other people here who get engaged in our disease, and many of the people here making excuses for them, whatever. There is people, it is a stress disease. The brain responds to stress in abnormal ways. Now, people kind of laugh at that a little bit, but really when you come down to it, the brain responds to stress in particular ways that produces the addiction. But there is one kind of stress that really, for men anyway, and there's millions of dollars being spent on trying to find out what the most stressful issue for men is in this disease and the development of it, and it's that. These are all the kinds of damage caused by the disease. This is all basic 101 stuff. Early, middle, late, and too late. Many of us have seen the tragedy of too late. There it is, standing at the graveside of somebody who's not been able to be helped. That's the old cucumber one. You know, if you're a cucumber, and if you change a cucumber into a pickle, can you change it back? I spent the first 6 years of my sobriety like an alchemist, trying to figure out a way to go the other way. Really, we're putting pickles in all kinds of solutions. Like alchemists wanted to turn lead into gold, I was trying to turn a pickle back into a cucumber and win the Nobel Prize, I thought. But it's a very useful model because once you're an alcoholic, once that switch is thrown, there's no way back. You go stuck with it. Thank God. These are what the predictable outcomes. Our friend Lynn Hankey's. There's a couple of other ups that I can't put in mixed company, which you can imagine what they might be. This is amazing. This is just a couple of years ago, Columbia University. 9 out of 10 general physicians in the U.S. do not recognize addiction in their patients when they see it. They will diagnose high blood pressure, gastroenterological problems, depression, anxiety, whatever else, anything other than addiction, because they don't know what to do with addiction. Furthermore, they have a very short period of time to see patients, so they will give them some Valium or some Prozac or some other thing in a 10-minute interview and send them on their way, leading the patient to believe and to assist in the patient's denial that they have any problem with alcohol. And worse still, 4 out of 5 of those physicians do not believe that addiction is a treatable disease. So they're not going to diagnose it anyway, because they'd be giving their patient a death sentence if they diagnose addiction. So it's buried and it's encrusted in this whole national system of denial, and in many ways the most dangerous place an active alcoholic or an addict can be is in a doctor's office. Because you may get the wrong diagnosis and the wrong medication that will simply perpetuate your disease. In some ways, the most dangerous place I can be is at UCLA or Johns Hopkins, my old universities, where I did my heaviest drinking, because my colleagues there was, come on, Garrett, you were never an alcoholic. You were just Irish. That was my diagnosis. And you drank like you did, so as we didn't have to drink as much as we wanted to. And they're saying, furthermore, we never saw you drunk. And you were much more fun in those days than you are now, going around preaching about alcoholism and so on. And they said, we remember the brilliant speeches you gave at the Southern California Psychiatric Society. I said, but I don't. And it means nothing to them. Every time I tried to stop drinking, they'd send me a case of wine. See, they just see the behavior, the symptoms, and not the underlying disease. And why should they? We don't educate doctors in hospitals, in medical school. About this, they get in UCLA until recently, they got 4 hours out of 4,000 about addiction, which will be the number 2 or number 3 disease they will see in their practices, no matter what specialty they're in. And that is general in Europe and in England, I'm sure in Spain and everywhere. So we're still laboring hard and strong in the trenches to try and educate the people who are really on the front lines, clergymen, the people who do diagnose alcoholism and addiction, most of all, who are they? Prostitutes, massage parlor therapists, liquor store attendants, policemen, and so on. They're the people who recognize it, because there is a certain significance and implication in recognizing it for them, because then they don't provide service to a drunk or a dangerous person. Let me show you a quick case. This is a case of a doctor. Again, to show you how deeply in denial top-class medical professionals are. This took place. It's a 20-year history of a doctor, young doctor who was headed for a career in surgery. And nobody during this 20-year history, except one person, a dentist, ever took a history of alcoholism. He was already a chronic alcoholic at the beginning of this history that I'll show you. And only one person ever mentioned alcohol in this 20-year period. And as an intern, he had an abscess on his right cheek, and he decided, like all great surgeons, that he would have surgery performed on him before he performed it on anyone else. And so he got a medical student, and together they went into the emergency room one night, drunk, both of them. And the medical student, with a book in hand, hacked at this abscess and created a fistula between his parotid gland and the outside, a draining fistula. And this became part of the legend of the hospital. Everyone knew they were drunk and that this was a terrible, horrible accident to occur, but it became just part of the lore of the hospital. Then he went on in his residency, and he was shown to have a depression and anxiety and an attitude. The committee met and questioned whether or not he was suitable for training as a physician. So instead, they sent him to a psychiatrist, sensible business, and paid for the psychotherapy. Eventually, that psychotherapy ended only when the psychiatrist was killed in a plane crash. The psychiatrist turned out also to be alcoholic. So they both discussed each other's alcoholism and drinking, but never did anything about it. Marriage counseling was happening. His marriage was falling apart, his first marriage at this time. At the same time, his career was actually going very well, but there was chaos at home. Very typical. Then he got terrible headaches, and investigations were done with angiograms of his brain, which at that time carried a 1% mortality. It was a very risky procedure at Johns Hopkins, and nothing was found. Then he had a period of 6 months impotence, which is very common in male alcoholics, and it'd be very strange for a female alcoholic to have a period of impotence, but nevertheless. Then he had more headaches and more investigations. Then the dentist came along, and he had palatine teeth, which were removed because they sometimes become cancerous. And when the teeth were removed from his teeth, all his front teeth fell out because his liver was rotten. And he had no healing power. And so he thought he was set for life because with no front teeth and being a doctor, nobody would listen to him. Even had no authority, and he could tune the dentist for millions of dollars. And so he looked forward to a life of rest and leisure, fueled by this dentist. But the dentist suggested that it wasn't the incompetence of the dentist, but the incompetence of this man's liver, at which point he did what we call a geographic, as many people know. Oh, you want me to? Okay. Now it'll perversely probably go over here. But he moved then to another city in the hope that his drinking would improve. And, of course, it did for a while, but then the tide came back in and he was just as alcoholic and more as he ever was. Then he went into psychoanalysis again with the best analyst in the town. No more and more, nothing ever about his alcoholism. He would go from the analyst's couch to the nearest bar and get drunk and then go home. More marriage counseling, fractured ribs, the most common surgical illness with alcoholism. He got two in the spring of 74 and three more in the fall because we bump into things and get hit by fists and other objects and steering wheels. And so fractured ribs, anyone with fractured ribs should immediately be taken a history for alcoholism. Then he had high blood pressure, multiple beats, heartbeats, was treated for the hypertension for the high blood pressure, multiple emergency room admissions for a rapid heartbeat. He'd be carried out of various places. Intermittent rectal bleeding, which he thought was due to eating too much Indian curry. So he just reduced the chronic diarrhea. What do you think of that? What do you think would happen to that? Do you think that's typical? That is typical. Many alcoholics will tell you they went and begging and pleading in code to the doctors to say they had a drinking problem, but never coming out to say it. And in the meantime, throughout all of this, if you can believe it, this particular man had all of these things. Look at these. The next two slides after this I'm going to show you. This is research now. Because I have showed this two slides after this one plus this one to 7,000 plus knowledgeable people, alcoholics and counselors, and nobody yet has suggested an addition or subtraction from it. So this is the portrait of a late middle stage or an early late stage alcoholic. These are what we have to do to survive. And anyone who comes to me and denies these is either just in full denial or they're not an alcoholic or an addict. Because you cannot be an addict and an alcoholic without being more or less this way. You might have 100% of these, but most people have 70-75% of these in their fourth and fifth steps. Any disagreement to that? Any additions, subtractions? Anyone want to write to the Council of World Services to object to this list? It's all in the big book anyway. Well, they're all mine. That history that I gave you is mine. And there are all the teeth that fell out. That's my history there, and I say it because those two things, the UCLA, the last part of the history, UCLA, and the first part of Sir Johns Hopkins, the two best institutions in the world. Doctors didn't know anything. Overlooked all of the symptoms. I could have died any time during that with my risk-taking behavior, other illnesses and so on. Didn't, for some reason I've been spared. Maybe to give lectures of this kind, I don't know, to people not a sophisticated, knowledgeable audience like this, but to audiences who don't know anything about this and need to be educated like other doctors. So it's very interesting, I find, when everybody agrees that this is the profile of a late, middle, early, late-stage alcoholic. Because the outside public don't know that. They don't know that we're like that. because we hide it so well, even from the ones we love the most. As Jimmy said this morning, his wife didn't know. You know, she only knew 10% of who and what he was. And behind every alcoholic, there's that. A deep yearning for intimacy, safety, and belonging. And what we get instead because of our behavior is rejection, humiliation, and dehumanization. I really believe in that word, for that we behave less than human. We are closer to the animals at very many times. And that there's a wonderful book by Kurtz called The Spirituality of Imperfection, which brings this out beautifully, and I recommend it to everybody. Well, big question. A lot of research going on in that. And that's the reason we have such a bad reputation, because we do terrible things. And that's the danger of saying, well, addiction is just like diabetes. Diabetics don't do the terrible things that we do or did when we were drinking, and for some time into our recovery until we get those energies harnessed properly. We are a dangerous group. I'm a dangerous person if I'm drinking. Dangerous. And I'm not exaggerating. And people who know me, my wife and my previous wife and my kids, they know that I can be dangerous when I'm drinking. And occasionally in recovery, when I regress to past ways of being under stress, when I don't know, when I get fits of powerlessness and can't utilize my program, have no access to my program, then I regress to earlier phases of being. Well, I'm just as dangerous as I used to be, except somehow I have a program, or I can pick up a phone, or I can turn to somebody. I can turn to a higher power, my higher power, whatever, to stop the madness. And that's what the program does for me. Without that, I'd be long since gone. That's just a statistic. Again, I'm sure it's true in Europe as well. See, we use drugs because we like what it does to our brains. Chronic prolonged use, I showed you this already, changes the brain in fundamental and long-standing ways. But the most important thing is that the addiction is the result of our brains becoming rewired. Well, I've shown you that slide before that got in. It looks simple when you say it's a brain disease, but this is more or less what it looks like when you try to confront it with the rewiring and the wiring and the re-rewiring and the tangled wires and the lights going on and off and everything. And they're just one solitary train. Where the hell is that going to go? And where is it going to end up? That looks like me on a lot of mornings, as a matter of fact. That's San Francisco. And I'm sure that's not posed. My colleague John S. Validates that. He vouches for the veracity of that. In the back it says, you're fired, Jack. The lab results just came back and you tested positive for coke. So mistakes can be made. It says, son, we found blood in your alcohol stream. So addiction is characterized by, sorry about that, the slide, impaired control over drug use, preoccupation with drugs or alcohol, continued use of the drug despite adverse consequences, and distortions in thinking, most notably denial. Now, this next thing is wonderful. It's by R.D. Laing, the great Scottish psychiatrist who wrote many things, including poetry called Knots. And this is the best thing that's written ever about denial and trying to deal with it. There must be something the matter with him, because he would not be acting as he does unless there was. Therefore, he is acting as he is because there is something the matter with him. But he does not think there is anything the matter with him, because one of the things that is the matter with him is that he does not think that there is anything the matter with him. Therefore, we have to help him realize that the fact that he does not think that there is anything the matter with him is one of the things that really is the matter with him. It's a wonderfully circular thing that all clinicians should know about. Now we go into some of the new research that's come out that puts a lot of this into pictures. I find this fascinating. And I'm no biochemist or neurobiologist, but these pictures I can understand a little bit, and I hope you can too. This is a normal brain. These are slices that are taken of the brain with MRI and PET scanning images that, like very complicated radiology x-rays. But they put dye into the patient's blood and radiated systems which light up areas of the brain. and a normal brain is behaving like this. A cocaine abuser, 10 days after, when he stops or she stops using cocaine, the lights are out. The brain is really functioning only in little bits and pieces, and yet at 100 days, here it is coming back. And this shows you that the damage is not permanent. It comes back, and you can retrieve the damage, which again is our clinical experience. Before we ever knew any of this, we knew that, and we used to watch, as a matter of fact, cocaine addicts at between 100 and 110 days for relapse. We had that, we could watch them that closely, and we knew that something was happening then, and it was that they were coming back, just as you have to watch a person who's been depressed once you leave them to the hospital, because they get energy once they leave the hospital, and then they can kill themselves. The time that most depressed people kill themselves is after they've received help, and they feel more energized and able to implement the destructive process. It's the same for this. This is amphetamines. Here's a normal person's brain, pre-amphetamine control. This is 4 weeks later. Look. Again, the lights are almost completely gone out. This is 6 months later. They're just beginning to come back. But 6 months. Here, 1 year. Here, they're coming back. See? And then I think this is 2 years later, and they're coming back, and they're almost back to normal. Not quite, but almost back to normal. So this shows that the drugs do have a distinct... And if you looked at every amphetamine addict, you would get a picture more or less like this. It's not just individuals. This is a group picture of amphetamine addiction. This is, again, the cocaine abuser. It's basically the same but enlarged. This is the frontal lobe of the brain where most things happen up here. And the cocaine, all of the reasoning, the humanistic aspects of being are gone. And they're beginning to go back here 100 days or 3 months later. This is what happens when you just... This is a normal brain here. You have a few drinks, and that's what happens. If you get intoxicated, 1 gram of alcohol per kilogram, this is what happens first. All of these red, lively parts go out, and this little walnut here occurs. So even with getting drunk once, there's a significant impact on your brain. Again, chronic alcohol use, for fear cocaine users here or alcoholics in the room might say, well, that's cocaine, those goddamn amphetamine addicts and cokeheads. I mean, it's not me. Well, here you are, introduced you to yourself, the alcoholics in the room. This is your brain. Effects of chronic use, you see the systems in the brain here. These are the vessels where the fluid is in the brain. They're much larger here than they should be. Now, they can, with treatment, shrink back again. This is, again, alcohol 10 days after stopping drinking. This is the uptake of sugar in the system. You can see it's not great. It's very depleted. But 30 days later, it's pretty good. It's not back to normal yet. But the brain is, again, improving itself, retrieving itself. This is irretrievable. This is what you'd see in a Skid Row alcoholic. This is a more or less normal brain. Here you can see these very enlarged ventricles in the brain and the atrophy here. See, this is all full here. These are all atrophied brain. You're actually having reduced brain mass in chronic alcoholism. That does not come back. That's wet brain damage. So going from abuse to addiction, it's as if there was a switch in the brain that gets switched, flipped at some point, where you become alcoholic as opposed. There are many heavy drinkers who can drink and get into difficulties, but they can stop more or less when they want to and when they have to. This switch flips at different points. It's sometimes genetically predisposed and so on. But the task for treatment becomes to compensate for and hopefully reverse some of the resulting brain changes. And 12-step programs and multidimensional treatment programs can bring about such changes in brain chemistry. We know that now. So when you bring a person into the hospital and you're treating them and you're loving them in 12-step context, their brains are listening, their brains are responding. As you love them, you're loving their brains as well, and the comfort and the quiet and the serenity that comes in, that is the rest that the brain needs to have in order to recover. This is where the switch is. This is the midbrain here where all the survival mechanisms are, impulses and sex and aggression and all of these things are right in here in the reptilian inner brain, and this is the frontal cortex where humanism resides, and it is between our behavior, our humanism, our humanitarian behavior, actually is a result of the interaction between the feeling part of the brain, the limbic system, and the frontal cortex. And it's somewhere here that this switch occurs and contact is broken off. So that the feeling part of the brain has no contact with the reasoning part of the brain, and that's what gets us into trouble. I'm going to move on. We don't metabolize sugar very well in diabetes, and the brain doesn't metabolize neurotransmitters very well in addiction. This is important. Addiction is a brain disease, but it has to do with the pleasure center. The slide is off center there. I'm sorry about that. It's all about pleasure, reward, and survival in the beginning. That's why we go for drugs. I didn't know anyone who took drugs, and many of us vomited the first time we drank, but we overcame that, and the pleasure came afterwards. And this is, again, a schematic of the brain. This is the frontal cortex that I've been talking about, where values, judgment, logic, reason, impulse, control, love, morality, decency, meaning, responsibility, connectedness, and spirituality reside. And this is the primitive brain where sexuality, aggression, and all of those things reside. And if this switch between, if the connection between this, the median forebrain bundle, between this part of the brain and that part of the brain gets cut off by addiction, that's when we're in trouble. Because we need that integration, that combination of impulse and reason for us to behave like human beings. And that's when we descend to animalistic behavior, because that's the part of the brain we share with the animals. They don't have this part of the brain. This is the names of the things. I put them in Latin because when doctors... Don't please. How do I stop this? I hate when this happens. Huh? Anyone got an idea? Is there a nerd? Huh? Don't! There are five voices telling me to do a different thing. Press previous. But what do I press? I know how to do it over here, right now. Go back to basics. See, this is doctor talk. When doctors are dealing with patients, they don't want the patient to know that they, the doctor, don't know what it is they're talking about. This is one of the great benefits of a Jesuit education for me, where I had to speak Latin at the age of 16 with the Jesuits. So these are the pleasure centers of the brain. But the patient doesn't know what the hell you're talking about, and you can charge higher fees when you speak to them in Latin, but they don't know what they've been getting. But if you've got a really bright patient who knows Latin, then you have to speak English. And this is the mesolimbic reward system that we were talking about, where self-preservation, procreation, parental care, insects, and play are located. But when it really comes down, if you've got a really intelligent patient that you want to get across to, you just tell them that's what it's about. And that's how we get into trouble when we get intoxicated, because all inhibitions are gone, and that's who we are. That's who we are, and there's pleasure attached to each one of those things, depending on the circumstances. I love it. I just put this. This slide has no business being there, except I love it. See the rattlesnake, and you see them, and then this affects the inner part of the brain. I love to put naked bodies or something there and see what happens. Have you changed your mind? That's a normal brain. This is one that's suffering from addiction. And indeed, our minds do change, don't they, with addiction. It's a brain disease. But more than a disease, it's a way of life. This is so important, and this is what people outside our field don't know, the extent to which addiction controls our lives and is our life. But to be successful, recovery must also be a way of life. And again, people outside don't understand that. After a month, they say, do you still have to go to meetings? Are they likely to send you a bottle of whiskey to celebrate your first birthday? I mean, that's not unusual. Somebody was talking about it today. So they don't understand the permanence of this switch that has taken place and the degree to which we have to go from one culture to another. The culture of addiction to the culture of recovery, which are fundamentally different. I'll talk about that in a moment. It's like going from here to Outer Mongolia without any knowledge of the language or the culture and being expected to set up a business in a month. We would be that bewildered and confused, and yet coming from the culture of addiction, where we have lived for 10 or 20 years, with all of those character defects surviving, helping us to survive, we bring all of those with us into recovery. And they can send us back to the culture with which we're familiar, the culture of recovery, of addiction, or we can begin to look at them, gradually abandon them, not too quickly, but over the time substitute other cultural values for to replace those ones that kept us alive for so long. We should be grateful in many ways to our character defects and not abandon them too quickly. Culture, shared beliefs and values of a group, beliefs, customs, practices. I think that Alcoholics and Addicts, it is a separate culture. We have our own beliefs and systems and agreed upon arrangements and prejudices and all of those things that non-alcoholic, non-addictive people don't have, don't need. These are the recovery expectations. We admit a person to the treatment center on a Monday with all of those things that we saw before and expect by the end of the week them to be this way. It's not too much of an exaggeration. Because we forget, the more, you see, we forget the gap and how alienated alcoholics and addicts really are from normal society. We are totally alien. And that's why we don't feel we belong. The answer is because we don't and shouldn't, because we're so alienated. And our belonging is riven with fraudulence, lies and deceit and all of the rest of it. And I think that there's a movement on to suggest that, you know, being addicted isn't really so bad. It's like having an emotional flu. Well, it isn't. It's a state of extreme alienation in which severe damage is done. And we have to overcome that. We have to accept responsibility for that. And in the United States, when we're looking for parity for insurance and government programs and all of the rest of it, parity for alcoholism, parity for addiction, we have to take that into account. And that's why AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, with the traditions, has survived, because it does not get into any arguments, any positions, any affiliations, any associations with anyone. It has no opinion on outside matters. In America now, there are all kinds of organizations growing up with very strong opinions on outside matters. We have our rights. Well, I often tell my patients that for the first year, you have no rights. And behave as if you have no rights, and you'll get further. Because you gave up all your rights. Not that the disease was your fault, but the behavior is your responsibility. Sobriety is a natural state for alcoholics. Getting sober is a form of culture shock. Do you agree with that? Because it's such a culture shock that people get sober and they don't know what to do except to drink or use. When you don't know what to do and you're an addict, you drink or use. And so, as for Bill Wilson, people think of spirituality as an esoteric thought process. It is really a way of life. That recovery reestablishes the pathways of connection between the structures we were talking about in the brain, opening the door to rehumanization of the addict. Because alcoholics are dehumanized by virtue of the way we are in our illness and our disease. And as soon as that furnace that gets going in the brain and consumes it has been ignited in a person's brain, it is outside the conscious control of its owner and can be stopped only by specific override mechanisms, like beheading is one they knew in the Middle East. Less radical ones, although sometimes less radical, not always, when it is applied to oneself. 12-step spirituality, the only known override mechanism with the consistent capability to stop this midbrain madness. There's nothing else that I know of. Short-term drug treatments, sometimes religion, if you're lucky. People get sober on their own. People get abstinent on their own. But the consistent capability to stop this midbrain furnace raging inside, I think the only thing that exists that I know of is, and of course I'm roundly criticized for saying this, in, as I was a month ago in San Diego, saying it to very expert neuroscientists and others who are now consumed by the idea that because alcoholism and addiction is a brain disease, therefore drugs ought to be the answer. And they do not understand that that can be a death sentence, quite literally. I think spirituality is being connected. These are largely my ideas, but they're what I've got from the big book and from my own spiritual training in Alcoholics Anonymous now, almost more than 27 and a half years of trying to be as sober as I can, but my path to where... Jesus.
Right now it's being very rocky and very zigzag in the profile, I can tell you.
So it's connected to something meaningful, and we'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow. Varieties of spiritual experience. Bill Wilson's famous one at the top of the mountain with bright white lights and clouds swirling around, and the most of the rest of us have gradual, slow, and barely noticeable spiritual evolutions. At least that's been the way it's for me. Which brings us to dealing with and overcoming shame, which I regard as the principal block to spiritual freedom and to becoming happy, joyous, and free. Shame is the mother of all blocks to getting more spiritual. I would like to say that all of us are spiritual. Spirare in Latin means to breathe. Anima means the soul, to be animated, to be alive. Some of it's like health, where we all have health, some more than others. We all have spirit. Spirit means breath and life in Latin, and we all have it. But how do we get more spiritual? This is an early picture of the Garden of Eden, taken by an enterprising paparazzi. The technique is very valuable. That the origin of that is in a vault, in an undisclosed location with Mr. Cheney. The reason it squashed up was the photographic techniques were a bit primitive at the time. But the point of it is that there they are in the Garden of Eden, and they were naked, but they were not ashamed, according to Genesis. And these are our role models, incidentally. And when they failed to conform to God's standard, and ate of the tree of knowledge, or the tree of the fruit, this is this wonderful picture. Here they are being driven out of the Garden of Eden. And do you see Eve's face and the anguish? And covering their genitals in shame. Adam, the last time you were ashamed, you didn't want to ever anyone to see you, see into your eyes. You'd want to look into anyone's eyes. You'd want to be exposed for who you are. Not just that shameful act, but all the other shameful acts of your life. And so on. Shame is such a deep and profound motion of identity. And so I always love this picture. And I always think that God should have actually given maybe Adam an additional limb. Because every picture, every photograph you've ever seen of Adam, he's always standing near a bush, which has a friendly frond to cover his... And as a result, who here or anywhere has ever seen Adam's genitals? Do we know that Adam had genitals? And Freud may well have been wrong. There's no such thing as penis envy. May have been the other way around. Adam envied her. We don't know any more about her either. So it's an interesting thought. This only came to me about a month ago in the middle of a lecture. But nobody has yet come up with an answer. Quickly going, we're coming in the last leg, the last furlong here. And it is about shame and loss of control. And then ultimately I want to show you a tragedy at the end. What all of these things have in common is loss of control. People who have a stroke, they think a thought but they can't say it. Or if they say it, they're dribbling and losing control. People with mental illness, people who get drunk, they lose control. Gambling and so on and so forth. Internet compulsivity, a huge problem now that's really underground and not come to the surface yet with vast implications. Eating disorders. Anyway... because loss of control is what's common to all of those things. And I think you would agree that loss of control is the defining characteristic of addiction. Losing control of the over the drug, whatever it may be. And that loss of control produces shame. if you have a stroke or your neurologic illness and you become incontinent. I did that without a neurological illness. I used to be at cocktail parties and have a light-colored suit, and I'd be talking to someone. The only thing I could think of here was monitoring my abdomen to hear the gurgles and wondering, was it going to be a fart or a turd or a dribble? So I never couldn't, because that was my only preoccupation. And I didn't know whether to turn around in case it had been a dribble that I couldn't feel and they'd see it. And so these are very anxiety provoking to be in company when you're a chronic alcoholic who's got GI problems. And it had to do with loss of control. I see a lot of things and how you have to abandon underclothes in various places and things of that kind because they're no longer wearable. This is not being drunk either. This is just being alcoholic in between being drunk. And so, again, most people don't know about these privations that we alcoholics and addicts have to put up with. But it does produce shame, terrible shame. Addiction breeds guilt and shame, both. And shame means you feel there's something fundamentally wrong with you, that you're defective in some way. Guilt means you've done something bad that you can make restitution for, you can make an amend for, but shame is a problem in the 12 steps. Because if you don't deal with the shame and you make your amends and your restitution and your reparations in the 8th and 9th steps, and if you haven't dealt with the shame, you'll feel just as badly. It's like a Chinese meal. You'll feel great for an hour, but when you're leaving your 9th step venue, you'll begin to feel just as bad as you ever did because you haven't dealt with the shame that it's not what you did wrong, it's that something wrong with you. And no amount of amend is going to make that difference. You have to do an internal, you have to work internally in connection to a higher power of your own choosing. And that is the brilliance, and I think that is the great miracle of the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, because more than any other psychotherapeutic technique, it goes deeply enough to really set yourself right with God, however you see God. And no other one that I know of does precisely that for alcoholics and addicts. It does it for other people, but not for people with our specific background. And as we've seen from the very beginning, or we read the big book, our specific background is really very narrow. Everybody has had the same experiences, lived through the same. That's why we listened to Jimmy this morning, and I'm sure everybody could identify with that, or Bob last night. Everybody can identify with something or all of what they say. So we have this disease. Lead to isolation and hiding. And that's why, again, the fellowship and the spirituality and the connectedness of 12-step spirituality is so healing and so essential. Because shame, as you think of the last time you were ashamed, you can't feel anything other than the shame. It blocks feelings, and that's another day's lecture, how valuable it is for certain purposes to block feelings and protect you from being overwhelmed with tsunamis of feelings that could do serious damage. So access to feelings is essential for recovery. You would agree with that. That's what the 12 steps are about. But what, again, shame, hiding, isolation, guilt, and silence. Another lecture that I think I gave here a couple of years ago in Salou had to do with the memory of the concentration camps and how people never spoke about what happened to them because of the shame. Not as much what was done to them in the concentration camps, the Jews and others, but what they did to themselves and each other in order to survive. The stealing, the murder, the allowing relatives, friends, lovers to go to death while they escaped. They were the things that couldn't be talked about. Ever. And that's where our system in AA, that's why psychotherapy, which can be supportive of AA, not the other way around. You'll always see psychotherapy, psychiatrists and therapists writing articles with AA as adjunctive to psychotherapy. It's the other way around. Psychotherapy, a skilled psychotherapist can be very adjunctive to AA, helping us to work through our resistance to really going deep with the 12 steps. But they can't do that. The addict is a spy. Think of it. I always think that with those character defects that the CIA and your MI5 or whatever it might be in Britain or Spain ought to go not to the universities, the great universities, to recruit their spies. They just should come here. Everybody here knows how to live underground and has done it for 25 years and, you know, knows how to mishandle information, knows how to resist interrogations, leading the police person to believe that person to believe they've been told the honest truth, and knows how to perform interrogations without the other person knowing that they're under scrutiny and interrogation. For example, reconstructing a blackout. How you do it, you know, carefully and over the day to know whether you should send flowers or leave the country or whatever, because you have no idea what happened. I mean, ordinary people don't need those skills, and we can't live without them. And in the United States, there are 25 million people, and at a time when the United States needs competent spies, they ought to be standing like the recruiters in colleges at the doorways to AA meetings, recruiting people to go and sort out the problem in Iraq and elsewhere. And we could do it. We would do it. The alienation, did you ever think of that word of alienation? Did you ever think of it that way? That the 25 million alcoholics and addicts in the United States are an alien nation underneath the national radar. I don't know how many you have in Britain or in Spain, but a lot. And people don't know about us. And often we don't know about us either, so it's a complex boundary. I didn't know that the Immigration and Naturalization Service in the United States put your psychiatric diagnosis on your blue card, but that's my official entry permit to the United States, and they put resident alien, which is what I've more or less been all my life. No matter where I am or what, I always feel a bit alienated, except here. It's the only place I really feel I belong. And this is the state of malignant shame that I think, unless one deals with the internalized shame of addiction that accumulates, then you end up with this. And this is like those other character defects. This is my own catalog of my own malignant shame. And this is why I remain in recovery. And one or another, this is what I struggle with every day. Every day. Bob said last night, you know, that he's still, it's very up and down, and we struggle with these things, and sometimes we have wonderful moments of illumination and freedom and elucidation and connection. They're ecstatic, exalting moments. But a lot of the time, and they only come because of acknowledgement of this kind of thing and our willingness to work on it. And that's what I don't know what other people can identify that, but you can't be really intimate if these things are active, because they defeat intimacy. So in order to get to here, you have to be able to work on these things as well. This too is, you know, anyone who's come from an abusive family, you read all the books, they all divide these things. I think we're in all of them. I came from a family in which I saw violence. There was sexual abuse of various kinds, and I was a witness and a victim at school and other places, and I survived that somehow, not undamaged, with a lot of wounds, and certainly the situation in my own family was nothing like what I've heard about other families, but it nevertheless was there. And I regard myself now as a victor of the situation, no longer a survivor or a victim. I've been through all those roles, but I have been through all of them because I perpetrated all of these things in my own families, my own children, my own spouses. Everything that I had seen and everything that I had promised myself that I would never perpetrate, that I would create families in which there was honesty and openness and love and affection and warmth and integrity. And there was some of that, but there was also all of this carried down from the generation to generation. And in our family, with my spouse who's here, we have two children, and they were both alcoholic and addicted, very seriously addicted. One has 19 years of sobriety, the other has 18. And they have children who've never seen any of us drunk. One of them is married to a woman with 16 years of sobriety, good sobriety. Their programs are wonderful. They help us in many ways, and we help them. And we've driven a wedge into our tribal alcoholism, which both of us brought to the marriage. And also, we've had tragedy. Our daughter-in-law shot herself on her 31st birthday about 7 or 8 years ago, longer, 10 years ago, leaving a 5-year-old daughter, her daughter, our granddaughter. And a nephew of mine shot himself on his when he was 33, after many years of addiction, shot himself with a .45 revolver. So we've had a lot of of suffering, but a lot of joy also. But it continues to be a struggle, and but the recovery is worth it because of the miracles that we're given and the joy we have and the relationship we have, of which we're both very proud. And but it has been, again, in recovery. My wife, she'll be speaking tomorrow. She'll speak about her own situation where we're both in long-term recovery, and that has made all the difference in our lives and all the difference in the lives of our families. So it's an extraordinary widening out of effect. I learned so much of what I'm talking about from investigating and studying the Holocaust, and that's another not days, weeks series of lectures about the spiritual value of suffering and the need for authentic suffering, as I said, of the need for that to move from the culture of addiction into the culture of recovery. That suffering, we've had so much suffering in our active days and so much punishment and administered so much suffering and caused so much suffering and caused so much harm to others. And you know, it struck me just actually also in the middle of a lecture about a month ago, 2 months ago, that like Coleridge is the Ancient Mariner, alcoholics and addicts, we hurt the ones we love the most. They're the ones that are mostly hurt. Not our employers, not our colleagues, but the ones we love the most, our spouses and our children and ourselves. We are the ones that suffer most in this terrible disease. What I'm going to show you now is just the last thing. This is a true tragedy of denial. John gave me these slides, as a matter of fact. It was a doctor in Florida who had been treated for alcoholism, but neither he nor his wife ever accepted the fact of the reality of their alcoholism, of his alcoholism and her codependency. And his situation devolved. This is his practice here. And one day he had gone, he was 2 years sober at the time, but had never accepted the need for sobriety or recovery, but had to because of the fact that he was monitored and in order to keep his license. And he went to Cleveland one weekend, which he'd done many times before, and see his friends. And his wife didn't hear from him on Saturday, and Sunday she couldn't contact him, and so she contacted the head of the program, and they went to his office. And they went in, and this is what they saw. There, his doctor's office, regular, ordinary Sunday afternoon, empty. But then menace. They saw the toilet with the blood stains here, and of course they were fearful. And they went to his desk, his laboratory, a little in the office, and he saw the drug addicts here will know what these things are. They're all bleach and things of this kind that drug addicts use when they're shooting up. These are various fentanyl and other narcotics. This was his, he was being monitored by the state. This was a special lock. This was the office lockbox for the drugs. But he, clever man, had fixed it so as he could open it from behind and get whatever drugs he wanted. And the lock was non-disturbed. This was supposed to be monitored by the office manager. And then he would steal drugs from the hospital to replace them here. This was found on the desk. It was not fired, but it was loaded. Then they came into the next room and they found blood all over the place. And here was, you've seen those when you had your blood drawn, a little butterfly cannula. This is a blood pressure cuff that he'd put on, as addicts do, to try and get a vein up to inject his drugs. Couldn't do it. This is the most tragic of all. These are Kelly clamps, hemostats to stop bleeding. Because he couldn't get a vein anywhere, he operated on himself. There's a femoral artery and a femoral vein here. He cut down on his own femoral artery and vein and got into the artery instead of the vein and bled out, died. A bleeding with fountains of blood. You can imagine the agony of that man, the physician himself, knowing the anatomy and knowing he was making a mistake. As it did, as the fountain of blood must have come and gushed, and the agony of being alone and knowing what might have been had he not denied it all. That's how they found him. There another place where he went trying to find a vein, living, breathing, feeling. his hand. That wasn't from that recent assault that he used to wear gloves to cover over the fact that he was using drugs all the time, and he must have made a telephone call for help in the middle of it all. Then in an interview in the newspaper, his wife said to the newspaper he could stop any time he wanted to, and he would. It wasn't like he did it all the time. It wasn't like every day. It was more for escape. And they were both involved in this recovery program. He wouldn't call an ambulance because he couldn't trust the doctors. Well, he may have tried to call an ambulance. She didn't want her 13-year-old son to grow up to be a doctor. That should be 37. And what was the cause of her death? Drug overdose. That's the disease of addiction, a tricky disease, as we understand it and accept it in all of its manifestations. And I believe I don't think that could happen to me now, but I don't want to say that because it might. But it certainly could have happened, something like that to me. I know people to whom things have, I never knew that man, but I know people to whom things just as horrible and tragic have happened. And their deaths must be appalling, knowing what could have been. And it pains me to know what I have. The gratitude. The gratitude that I have for what I have and what we have, my relationships, the fact that I really have no problems except the ones of my own making, and the struggle to be happy, joyous, and free, which we do experience with great increasing frequency. But I'm so grateful for this program because it has liberated us from this kind of terrible tragedy, terrible outcomes which go on all the time. And anything I can do to teach people, to help people to understand this, this is why I do what I do at this point. So with that, I'd go back to Tim and thank you all for your attention. I often, because I don't ever know how to finish something like this. It brings you so close to seeing people all the time and this sort of tragedy, and yet at the same time the incredible triumphs that we see in our center and elsewhere. So sometimes I play a little music to finish it. Two songs I'll play, you know them both. You can sing along. One is a song of exile, alienation and exile. It's an Irish song, and the other is a song of surrender, an American song. Thank you.
God bless.
Thank you very much, Garrett. And now a couple of announcements from Mike. If he will, while I gather myself.
Hi, I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Practicing the 10th step. Somebody registered after lunch and before this meeting, and I didn't thrust one of these into his hand, his or her hand. I'm not absolutely sure. It was Anders, that's right. and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Please come and collect that. The really good news is I'm not alone. This was left, would you believe, on the bar downstairs. Who ever heard of an alcoholic leaving something on a bar? I don't know. Anyway, it sat there all during this morning's meeting, and some kind soul picked it up at the end of the meeting and brought it back to the registration desk before an unauthorized member of Alcoholics Anonymous rushed off with his souvenir mug. So if anybody picked up a goodie bag this morning and has lost it, we have it at the registration desk. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. By the way, we have these mugs for sale, the coffee mugs, the souvenir coffee mugs of the convention. They are €5, I believe.
Yep.
And if you'd like to bring one home to a friend or to your sponsor or someone as a souvenir, we'll have them available at the hospitality and registration desk. I wanted to say that we try to present a wide variety of things at this convention. This is maybe an unusual type of convention, we've been told. And we try to present a wide variety of things. This type of thing, on a personal level, Garrett's lecture has been very helpful to me over the years as far as helping me recover from the guilt and shame I had about being an alcoholic that Garrett talked about. And I think I have little shame about being an alcoholic. I have guilt about some of the things I did in my act of alcoholism, some of which I can never make amends for. But as Clancy, who was last year here, he says, sometimes you just have to make amends to the universe. And I believe that. So if you enjoyed this type of thing at this convention, please help me give Mr. Garrett O'Connor, Dr. O'Connor, another round of applause, please. Dr. O'Connor's lecture tomorrow afternoon at this time in this room will be on character defects, mainly procrastination. So don't be late for that meeting.
And there will be a meeting.
Thank you again. Are there any other brief announcements on behalf of AA, Jim? Thank you. The first Al-Anon meeting, this is organized by Jim and Barbara of Seattle, will be at the Raymar 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. Thank you. Now.